which is designed to look at those complicated topics. Our key goal is to identify means of accelerating innovation and advancing the nation's competitiveness and providing the jobs and growth that we so very much need. And this is one effort to focus on an area of contemporary policy interest. We're proud to say that under the guidance of Dale Jorgensen and Larry Summers and now Ed Penhote here at the table, that we've done work in this area for some time, and we're pleased that it's now available for those. We're looking, briefly put, both at what we do in this country with major programs, such as SBIR, the Technology Innovation Program at NIST, or the Semitech Consortium. We're also looking, which we don't do a lot in Washington, we like to talk about the global economy, but we tend not to actually look outside the Beltway. And outside the Beltway, there is a global economy, and a lot of countries are working extremely hard at making good the deficiencies in their innovation systems. And those efforts are, of course, shaping the international competitive environment. It's also a way of learning. For example, some of our work on IMEC in Flanders shows ways of organizing consortia, which can be very useful to us as we seek to do things. You'll notice people like Mary Good and Alan Wolf and Jack Gansler are devoting very considerable time to making these things work. I'd like to offer you as a gift a series of volumes on comparative innovation policy. They are available out front. We were very impressed the last meeting we held way back in April 23rd. Over 200 of these volumes left with our guests, so we are pleased if you would like to look at them. One of the key things that we found, and we're very happy to see that this administration is embracing it, is that partnerships work. They work in, they're good in principle, and they work in practice as long as they're properly structured, funded, and managed. And of course, as all of you know here, the devil is ever so often in the detail. We are also hoping that the SBIR program will be reauthorized. About the only thing it does is help convert research into companies, jobs, growth, and new options for our government leaders. I'm reminded of the A123 battery company up in Massachusetts, and many of you heard is a key element in the Chrysler strategy for electric drive vehicles. Well, that's an SBIR company from 2003, and that gives an option not only of creating a few jobs, but perhaps saving 60,000 or 80,000 jobs. You'll know the Congress has just recently changed the Technology Innovation Program. You're going to hear a little bit about that from the TIP director, Mark Stanley, a little bit later today. And one of the things that we are focused on a great deal in our program of work is looking at the connection with industries and how with universities and how they are able to galvanize a region's growth. And we have two outstanding university presidents, President Crow from Arizona State and President Parenza from Akron, both who will be talking about their efforts. I've already mentioned the consortium, but this is one of the key questions we'd like to leave in the discussion today. That is, how do you capture the benefits of the stimulus package and the rising R&D budgets for the U.S. economy? That is, how do we address the locational competition? We have challenges that our country faces, but only too often the locational challenge seems to be left out of the equation. And the way we believe you can do that as a first step, not as a last step, but as a first step, use what you have, use what you know works, and use those to support the innovation by small and medium-sized companies that support both the large companies and also provide procurement officers with greater choice. So this is part of a broader range of efforts. A number of you have been here many times before, and we're very pleased to see you again. Some of you are new, and we're delighted to see you. So we're looking forward to a lively and constructive discussion. We'd like to stress that we'll very probably outline the findings of this study, or the results of, I'm sorry, the results of our deliberations today. Your contributions can be valuable for both state and for national policy. We'd like to thank our sponsors, because without their help, none of this would be possible. And I'd particularly like to thank Christine Gabrielle, who's was an early funder, shall we say, for the, as all those of you who are familiar with early stage finance know, it's the first money that is the hardest money. And we're very grateful to the Heinz Endowments for having encouraged us, and, of course, for NIST that has a longstanding relationship with us. It's now my pleasure to introduce Ed Penhote, who is the chairman of the Board on Science, Technology, and Economic Policy, and a man who is an exemplary American that he's done just about everything.
I don't know what you mean by that, Chuck, but nevertheless, we'll continue with the discussion. Just let me add my welcome to that. Chuck, thank you all for coming. This is an important initiative for STEP. We really do believe that local initiatives are an extremely important element in the economy. It would be hard for me to argue otherwise, being from San Francisco, the home of Silicon Valley and one of the major outposts, if you will, for the biotechnology industry as well, both of whom grew out of local universities. We're delighted to be here today and look forward to not only the presentations, but hopefully some vigorous dialogue as we go along from you to help us think through these issues going forward. We're very honored this morning to have Susan Crawford with us. Susan is a Special Assistant to the President for Science, Technology, and Innovation Policy. She's also a member of the National Economic Council. She's on leave from the University of Michigan Law School, where she normally hangs out, but has joined the Obama administration. Susan is a delightful person, but in addition to that, she's a very committed to this whole area of really trying to build upon the innovative capacity of the U.S., and I think that it's wonderful to have a person with her energy and her commitment to this field in the White House structure. So Susan is here this morning to describe a little bit about what they're doing at the White House. Susan, thank you again for coming, and please.
Well, good morning, and thank you all for having me here. I'm delighted to get the chance to talk to you, and I do hope we have a vigorous dialogue, because my job this morning is to say, let's have that dialogue and to encourage you in your work. We are very committed to the idea of regional economic clusters and their role in economic growth and innovation. I want to tell you what's going on in the White House. That seems to be one of my charges here. So together with my beloved colleagues from the Office of Science and Technology Policy, Jim Kohlenberger and Tom Khalil, we have initiated an interagency innovation group, innovation and information policy group with very high-level attendance from all of the agencies. We also are following that up with many bilateral discussions about how best we can forward the administration's innovation agenda, most particularly with the Department of Commerce, which has a very special role to play here, I believe. It is the department of everything, and it can be the department of innovation. And our secretary there, Gary Locke, is terrific. I hope you all have an opportunity to work with him. Has enormous energy and focus, and when he decides something needs to get done, it gets done. So innovation is a core pursuit in terms of innovation policy, all the many things that go into that. It's a lot to get your arms around. It is nothing in particular. It is everything at once, and we have a great deal of work to do. But in a very focused way today, I want to talk about clusters and what the role of government there could appropriately be. This can't happen top down alone. We know that. It also can't happen bottom up alone. And government's role may be to provide a trellis of sorts. Biological metaphors come up all the time in discussing clusters. A set of evaluative metrics, assistance with funding, maybe that's fertilizer, not the trellis. and and also a goal. What kinds of outcomes do we want to see from these clusters? This is all extraordinarily difficult, is this idea of providing strategic funding, targeted, strategic, helpful funding that leads to a sustainable effort. So it seems to require the existence of the pre-existence of something successful on the ground that needs to be encouraged. So building on the gardening metaphor, perhaps we have green shoots with a great university nearby, which needs some fertilizing and some trellis activity. Innovation is always continuous, evolutionary, inclusive, and it's not, as you all know better than I do, it's not just about invention, but also about dispersing those inventions into the world so that they are successful. And dynamic, healthy clusters can help facilitate this entire evolutionary process. Geographic density and localism, as has already been mentioned, has a great deal to do with this. The university element, I'm very interested in seeing how universities can be at the heart of innovation clusters. And then the attitude of both fierce competition and cooperation in a never-ending cycle of industries competing with each other to provide the lowest cost, best services in a particular area while cooperating in loose, informal ways. We've seen that the success of Silicon Valley has a lot to do with the easy flow of information and people between and among firms. So the cooperative nature of cluster firms can allow these informal and formal social networks to emerge, which creates knowledge spillover, which is essential to these evolutionary engines to keep charging along, and allows iteration, modifications to be made repeatedly, so nothing's stuck. Again, very biological, very dynamic, moving constantly. And we're good at describing successful clusters after they happen. Silicon Valley always comes up. Look at all these elements, see how they work together. There's a cluster. But what can the federal government do to best assist them? And I have some questions for you, and we need your input. We know that more than 200 programs across the federal government fund regional economic development in a variety of ways. It might make sense to pluck two or three of those programs or elements of those programs and create a one-stop shop, or maybe the better visual for this is a mall of programs that could help clusters along their life cycle. I don't mean to suggest that we would want to create yet another federal agency to serve as the mall. This can be done with just a few purposeful people, both inside and outside the agencies. It can be done with White House assistance to say these programs should really work together so that our funding can be more strategic, more targeted, and more effective, so that regions who come to us will know where to go and how to reach out to find, to get access to that funding. So the question for you is, you have a lot of experience in this area, which programs would be good candidates for a pilot in this area? No one wants to see centralized control of all 200. The whole system will be brought to its knees. Wouldn't make sense. But a few, maybe two or three or four, that could be drawn into this easy availability for regions that have their act together and are looking for an easy interface with government. This administration sees as one of its top priorities improving the interface with government. That's where all this effort on transparency is coming from, so people understand how government works and can gain access to it. So question for you, which programs make sense? Which should be leveraged intelligently? In a sense, cluster policy should mimic clusters themselves. So we're in a never-ending circle of understanding of clusters. We gain efficiencies by targeting our efforts and breaking down silos, combining elements of these different agencies that may overlap. But another important element here is recognizing the balance between top-down sort of decree about clusters and bottom-up leadership. It's so important to find that local leader who makes things go and is as tightly networked and understands how the community works and can draw together resources. Maybe another question I have for you is, what are the outcomes, the metrics, the evaluative constructs that we should be employing when we're dictating or trying to encourage the development of dynamic, healthy clusters? What outcomes are we looking for? it seems to us that outcomes should be tied to national priorities, that they will then have a greater sense of success. The administration is very engaged in clean energy policy and reducing our carbon footprint. So clusters that focus in that area might be a good idea, but also extremely interested in lowering the cost of healthcare, and something that's near and dear to your hearts, increasing the educational resources of this country and access to them by both young people and adults, so that particularly in science and math education, we are helping our people to thrive in the 21st century economy, yet another gardening metaphor. Sort of the thriving populace, good education. But what outcomes in cluster policy should be desirable? So that's my introduction. We are all in this together. Our doors are open. And I'm very interested in engagement with you and through this society to you. So my only word today is onward. Thank you.
Would you take a question or two quickly before we move on? Anybody have any issue they'd like to bring up? Could you start?
I'm Jane Siegel. I'm with the International Trade Administration at the Department of Commerce. About a year or so ago, I was looking on behalf of the then secretary at localities for the secretary to convince legislators to support trade agreements. That's why I was doing this. And I came across San Antonio, Texas, and their economic development arm, which in 2004 had kind of put together what I thought was a plan for developing itself as a cluster. One of the things that stood out was they had a lot of population that needed language training. I thought at the time it would be a good idea for various incipient developing clusters to make proposals on what they would do with federal money if they could get it. I still think that's a good idea. I don't know whether you've considered that. That would sort of be bottom-up, a competition, getting economic development agencies from various emerging potential clusters, putting together information about their locational advantage and competing for federal money.
The idea of competitions is one that's very sympathetic to this administration. I think that again, the challenge is innovation for what? Cluster for what? So what's the outcome that you're trying to drive by encouraging a competition? I mean, if you have just an open competition, any region come and tell how you'd like to be more successful. There are risks with that, that you end up sort of dribbling money all and not understanding what you've gotten out of it. So one thing we'd like to avoid is that, and try to be very purposeful and intentional about, you know, clusters for what? What are we trying to obtain? But I think a competition might be a great idea. We'll see what happens with that. Certainly that notion is in the air.
Hey, one more question. Yes, go ahead.
Scott Sklar with the Stella Group. I work with medium-sized small businesses in the clean mm-hmm. energy side. And what we're finding is the myriad of wonderful government programs and the new emphasis by the administration, which is great, and I resonated that none of them cooperate with each other.
Right.
But I want to take a look at, is the administration or are you personally looking at how you blend the business side of the equation, like SBA and the Rural Utility Service at USDA, and TDA and OPIC and XM, and the science side, so they can actually be a little more agile and hand off to each other. And because that's really what's missing. There is no agility. It's all these stovepipes, and anecdotally they do, but not in a real agile way. So we lack the cluster here, actually, to even deal with any clusters outside of the Beltway.
Well, here's a partial answer to your question, which is that we're privileged today to have Karen Mills from the SBA, who will be speaking to us, and she works very closely with people on the National Economic Council. Mm-hmm. And also, we're all working as closely as we can with the science agencies and with ag, and whoever else we can find to cooperate with. Your guidance as to who best to pull together is very valuable to us, but this is exactly the direction we're trying to take to, because it's not just ideas over here and business over here, but how they work together.
It's that interaction.
It's the interaction.
And I just want to say briefly that it is important, while you get the folks from Mount High in these agencies or scientific institutions, there are folks within that actually have to do the work that
yes.
need to be the ones that are brought out and empowered. So.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we're a team, and we have a long way to go.
Thank you. I'm sure Susan reads her emails regularly, so we'll have to move on today. But anyone wants to send Susan a question or a message, thank you again, Susan, for joining us this morning. Our next speaker is Michael Crow. Michael is the president of Arizona State University, a post he's held now for 7 years, since 2002. Before that, he was at Columbia, responsible for research and for their tech transfer activities. And since coming to Arizona, Michael has worked very hard to raise the status of Arizona State University, but also to work hard to generate a interesting cluster within the state of Arizona. You know, the university, the relationship of university research, especially to clusters of innovation, is hard to overstate. If you take Silicon Valley, the example everyone points to, of course, Stanford University played an extremely important role there. If you look at the biotech industry, which is today one of America's most robust industries, it's located primarily in five locales: in Boston, in Research Triangle Park, in Seattle, Washington, in the San Francisco Bay Area, and in San Diego. Why is it in those places? Because it sprang from the universities, which developed the fundamental technology of biotechnology, and it was in those locations. All of these organizations essentially grew out of university research. So there are abundant evidence that universities play a critical role. I think going forward, one of our challenges is to think about the timing of universities' role. You know, probably the NIH funding, for example, started in a significant way in 1950. Biotech didn't grow as an industry for 25 years after that until 1975. So are there ways to stimulate the innovation business, if you will, from university research that don't have a 25-year lag associated with them, I think is one of the challenges to face. And I think Michael has some recent experience that he's here to share with us in that regard. So welcome, Michael. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ed. And I thought what I would try to do today is just give you some report basically from the front, if you will. I'm from that part of the United States, 2,500 miles away, that's going through rapid, unbelievably up and down gyrations of economic progress, social progress, and cultural complexity. My university is headquartered in a city that has grown by a factor of 13 in the last 50 years. We have a 50% decrease in property values in the last 12 months. We have a 40% decrease in state revenues in the last 18 months, following on 3 years with 25% increases in state revenues, just to give you some sense of the way in which those parts of the American economy and those parts of our culture are evolving rapidly. So I am from one of the North American cities located in the United States that's still in its early stages of generation, its early stages of evolution, and that's the way that one needs to look at things. In that context, then, here it is, the year, let's just round it off to 2010, when you think about innovation clusters, at least from our perspective, as the only research university in a city of 4 million people that's growing to be a city of 8 million people, let me just put that into perspective. We're going to be growing to the size of Chicago, Metro Chicago, and at least at the moment, we're the only institution there. We take on the role that we play in terms of attempting to facilitate innovation as a critical, fast-moving part of the culture in a way where, and I have to tell you this from the outset, begins with the complete and total restructuring of the university itself. So just assume that we are 7 years into that project, 7 years into the redesign of the institution in every possible way, which means the things that I'm about to say are actually doable. So the rates of innovation in universities is so close to the number zero that it's an unusual thing to be able to say that you can actually evolve the institution. So what are we doing? What's our goal? Our goal is to be a part of and to be a central node of what we call an integrated knowledge, discovery, and commercialization network. We realize that we play one role within that network, and those three functions, knowledge creation, knowledge and discovery, and commercialization are absolutely important. Now, to move forward, what we found is that all the things that went on in Santa Clara County and Alameda County and San Diego County and other places where innovation clusters in the past have evolved, all that's good. All of that's very interesting. And if you attempt to replicate any of what was done in the other places, you will fail. Your probability of failure will be so close to 100% that it's not worth even trying. That means that what you need to do is to learn from each of those experiences. If you're from another location, you're talking biotech, you're talking this, you're talking that, you're probably already on the path to failure. And so what one needs to think about when one moves forward is how to learn all of the lessons up through 2010 that's gone on everywhere else, and to draw from all the programs and all the opportunities and all the other things that are out there, and then to start moving in new and different kinds of ways. Here's four things that we're doing, and then I want to deal with some of Chuck's questions that he asked me to address specifically. But here's things that we're doing. We're dealing with what we call new knowledge clusters. In this case, that means we're taking existing industries, already successful over 3 or 4 decades in our present location, and rather than stepping past them and thinking that somehow we're going to then evolve some completely new industrial cluster, what can we do for that industry to be successful? So it turns out in Metro Phoenix we have an unbelievable concentration of aerospace manufacturers. They build helicopters and they build missiles and they build this and they build that. And it turns out that those companies, which don't talk to each other and don't generally talk to the universities in the way that you would think, they hire our engineers, of which we produce more than 1,000 per year, high quality engineers, so we have that kind of transaction. Our knowledge creation enterprise is not sufficiently plugged into those entities in a way and on a local basis to help them to continue to be competitive. And so this notion of creating new knowledge clusters around the existing industries is an important step. Not to be so enamored with, well, you know, we've got to do something new like they're doing in, you know, Palo Alto. Well, no, what they do in Palo Alto that used to be new becomes old at some point, and then they have their base and they have to work with that group. The second thing that we do, and this has been a hard-fought lesson for us, we started working on what we call group problem solving. And I'll give you a couple of examples. We have a project where the Army gave us $100 million in a completely new experiment, and the Army said, don't do research and don't do problem solving and don't do scientific assessments about new materials and new displays and new technologies. You cluster yourself together with whoever you have to bring together. We'll give you $100 million. And what we want you to do is to figure out how to manufacture the following thing. We know we need this thing. No one can build it. Please assemble whatever's necessary and don't tell us what scientific papers you wrote. Whatever you write, that's great. Put that off to the side. Whatever you do relative to your academic progress, that's great. Isn't that wonderful? Do all that. All we want is the thing. In this case, a flexible display, wearable on a soldier's uniform in combat. That's all they want. And so what we found was then 30 companies that would work with us, small companies, companies that had to be created, other companies that have been created to be a part of solving that problem, the facilities that we brought online, the $100 million that we brought in place, and a completely differentiated mindset. The differentiated mindset was solve the problem, build the end product. A second one of these group problem-solving techniques that's driving our innovation cluster, which I think is really important, is we take on a problem. So it turns out that Phoenix itself is now larger than Philadelphia. It has a huge energy footprint in a very complex ecosystem. And so we have advanced the notion between the university, the city, and the private sector of taking the carbon footprint of Phoenix itself as a city to the lowest possible number. So that's the objective of this group learning process. Take the carbon footprint to the lowest possible number. by whatever means necessary. And that means innovations and problem solving and modeling and networking and materials advancement and working together and doing things in different ways. And so what we're finding is that these kinds of group problem solving initiatives are changing the way in which we're able to innovate and move forward. I think another example of that, where we've been able to bring in funding from EPA and funding from local industries and funding from private foundations and funding from donors, is we've decided to start picking something Susan was talking about, which is outcomes. So it turns out in metropolitan Phoenix, and don't let the locality of the problem that I give you throw you off the point that I'm trying to make. So the average nighttime temperature in Phoenix has gone up by over 10 degrees in the last 20 years. That's bad. It affects the ecosystem, it affects energy consumption rates, it affects quality of life, it affects all kinds of things. So we have clustered together a range of companies, the university and others, and federal agencies around the notion that we have one objective. We will not know that we are successful until we have collectively lowered the trajectory of the nighttime heat index. So that objective becomes the means, the outcome that we seek, and that is what drives both our organizational innovation as well as our actual physical manifestation of innovations. Another tactic that we've been using is what we call innovation laboratories. So we found endowment to build a student entrepreneurship enterprise that actually funds student ideas for companies and launches them through an innovation cluster that we put together in a new, not a research park. We don't have one of those. We have one of those. That's like passe and old news. We have an innovation center now, which is completely different, with public sector, private sector, philanthropic contributions. And so the notion is bringing these innovation laboratories together, and they have one objective. One objective only: start new enterprises. That's the only objective of the innovation laboratory. Some are clustered around students, some are clustered around certain communities, some are clustered around specific problems. So one of the problems that we're clustered around is educational technology for advancing and speeding up learning. So one of the innovation clusters that we have, with companies from around the world, companies from around the United States, assets that we have from the university that we've all positioned into a single location, is let's take the objective, speed up learning. Let's bring everybody that's interested in speeding up learning, and we create this innovation laboratory where we have one product outcome: create new enterprises. That's it. That's the only thing that we're trying to do. I think the last thing that we've done, and I'm not giving you a comprehensive list, but I'm trying to give you a sense of how we're approaching this. If we take the standard models that have been in place from the 80s and the 90s, they're not going to work. They're not going to work in Phoenix. I don't know if they'll work in Akron, but I doubt it. And so you need new ways. And so one of the things that we've found is that we've got no way for people to talk together between engineering and science and business. And so we began building tools. So one of the tools that we built, we raised $6 million, and we built a thing called the Decision Theater. And this is a room like this room, a little bit smaller, with a 270-degree wraparound screen and a supercomputer, and it allows you to do something that you can't do anywhere else, which is to bring in people that don't speak the same language and start solving problems together. So one of the problems that we're working on in this room is a thing called RenewSim. It's a simulation of, let's assume you wanted to produce 20 gigawatts of solar-derived electric power in Arizona to fuel both Arizona, Nevada, and Southern California with new energy. Turns out that the number of problems limiting your ability to do that is so large that most people give up, particularly on the distribution problem, not the production problem. So if you can bring everybody together around the innovation challenge and give them a tool to simulate all of their inputs, the engineers, the business people, the electric utility people, the corporation commission which sets the electric utility rate, those are barriers to innovation. And so we're using this tool as a way to break down the barriers to innovation to solve the problems so you know where to put your innovative energy. And so that's a fourth thing that we've been doing. Now, Chuck asked me several questions that I'd like to quickly address. One thing he said: what are the synergies and the gaps, in a sense, between public and private partnerships, between the federal government, regional enterprises, universities, state universities, and so forth? And so here's something that I think is absolutely a fundamental failure in American innovation policy, and that is our failure to recognize local expertise, local capability, and regional innovation capacity. So I'm going to pick Karen, is she still here back there? She was here. Karen Mills. She's going to talk later, and I talked to her earlier, and she and I have known each other for a long time. And so she and I have talked about how in Maine, where she's from, they have expertise in X, Y, and Z, let's say in boat building and things that you might imagine. And if you look at the University of Maine and you looked at its profile of its expertise relative to the local innovation capability, there's no correlation whatsoever. The University of Maine is trying to build a materials research center when just down the road at the University of Massachusetts is a fantastic world-class materials research center that they could be linked to and clustered with. But where are the people, and you'll laugh when I say this, where are the American experts on boat technology, on new materials for boats and new engines and new this and new that, so that they, you know, the whatever it happens to be, whatever the technology happens to be, or eco-friendly fishing equipment, or whatever the technique happens to be, we're not drawing from local expertise. It's as if we don't get it. The Italians, I think, get this the best. They're pretty disorganized, so they're not able to leverage it, but they get it the best, and we just don't get it. So we don't leverage local assets. We don't have regional innovation clusters built around local expertise. What should the administration be doing to leverage its programs and its investments with what's going on in the regions? Well, it goes back to this notion of identifying regional problems that have national merit. If you can solve a particular regional problem, so let's take an ecological problem like the Everglades, a train wreck in motion happening before our very eyes with massive amounts of innovation related to mining, related to agriculture, related to city building, related to water handling, related to energy distribution, related to ecosystem management, related to fisheries and hatcheries and all these things. A huge innovation problem. That's not the way we approach innovation. There's nobody that says we're going to solve the Everglades problem, and then by solving the Everglades problem, we will produce 500 innovations in a whole series of industries around the causality of that problem. So leadership in the federal government right now can't pull that off. It takes work. And we haven't focused on those kinds of problems. Now, you also asked, Chuck, how do we accelerate? How do we move more quickly? And I think Susan took some of my thunder here because she's on the exact right track. It's all about outcomes. Right now, we think the outcome is how many dollars did we spend on science? And that out of that, we'll get some fantastic return. Well, luckily, we do. But it's in spite of ourselves in some ways, because we're not focused sufficiently on outcomes. And so let me give you an outcome. So we all know that we're failing in math and science education in K-12. I mean, we're getting our tails whipped around the world. We're not producing the right kinds of teachers. We're not training in the right kinds of ways. We're not keeping up. The President of the United States, who visited our campus a couple weeks ago, and we spent several hours with him, he said on February 24th, I want every kid to graduate from high school. Every kid. I want half of them to then go on to some level of secondary education, and I want them all to be at the highest level of whatever the global math standard happens to be. Well, guess what? We're not moving in that direction. We got little chances of success with the rate of innovation that we presently have, and where then is the national innovation cluster working on that problem? Give me every possible tool imaginable that can drive math learning across every cultural cross-section of this country, in every family of every income, every tool imaginable. We don't have it. We've got this project here, and a couple projects over there, and NSF doing this, and DOE doing this, and DOD doing this. But we don't have anybody working on that kind of innovation problem, because that's probably something that people would say, well, what's that all about? Well, there's a huge industry in that also. There's a huge economic return in that. And so this notion of how do you accelerate, you focus on outcomes. You focus on investing in regional institutions. You focus on investing in clusters around specific problems. And you focus on these outcome measurements. We need to get away from, so when I was at Columbia for 12 years, I was a professor of science and technology policy, and there were two of us. And so we were oddballs, because we used to say things like, you know, we really ought to know why we're doing all this science. You know, we really ought to know what the reason is we're doing all this, and sort of what we hope to achieve. And, you know, if we had certain things that we were working toward, would it make science different? And I remember a couple of us were thrown out of the Pew Memorial Trust once for being heretics because we were talking about guiding science to certain outcomes. You can't guide science. No, you can't guide what goes on in a scientific laboratory. But you can certainly say what outcomes that you want. And so one thing that we're doing is we're looking at innovation and innovation clusters with insufficient outcomes, insufficient outcome measurements, and insufficient tools to measure those outcomes. So just pick that math and science education one, just as an example. That is a huge economic development opportunity, a huge innovation opportunity, a fantastic mechanism to drive problem solving, and it's not even on our list. It's not even something that we move forward to. So from my perspective, what we need to do is, at the federal level in particular, is move up from the project mode of thinking and start thinking about these innovation clusters that are driven by particular outcomes and finding ways to facilitate those. And so back in Phoenix, what I can say is that standard stuff seldom works. Seldom works. We still argue with people back in Phoenix about why there's a government, so we have other issues. But let me tell you that the country is evolving so rapidly and the problems are so challenging that any standard approach that's not somewhat regionalized or localized is not likely to have a high degree of success. And so we need this customization. And customization comes, I think, through these establishment of these new kinds of innovation clusters, new kinds of tools, and these new kinds of outcome measurements. So, Ed, thank you.
Thank you, Michael. I think you can see why Arizona State, previously known best as a party school,
yes,
moving into a forefront.
Even lately, we've been characterized that.
Maybe we have time for two quick questions. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Adam Rosenberg. I work for the House Science and Technology Committee. Most of what you described sounded great. I think everyone supports regional initiatives, having universities, states, and the local private sector working together towards innovation. I think when you get to the national level, there's a real big concern. For example, there's the Brookings proposal, which I think you've come out on record in support of, which would create like $100 to $200 million a year institutes,
regional
which
energy centers, right?
Right, or yeah, what's in a few other proposals, and that quickly becomes an earmark. I think that quickly becomes something that's hard to get rid of. We have 17 national labs, and we have major universities such as your own throughout the country. How do we avoid that happening?
A very good point, and so and I know Chairman Gordon is concerned about this, and other members on the committee. And so the one way to avoid it is that it's competition. We happen to be a no earmarking school. We have senators that if you utter the word earmark, you're put to death. And so we just, rather than have that as the outcome, we have gone down other paths. But it's also wise policy. And so the way to avoid that is to take ideas like the regional energy ideas that are in the Brookings study that I was the co-chair of, and to make certain that as you move it to the national consideration by groups such as the members of your committee, you move away from every tendency to make it into some kind of local, capturable, earmarked, less than meritorious thing. So there's a way that that's happening right now. Undersecretary Koonin and Secretary Chu are advancing these energy hub projects. There's 8 of them on the street that they're calling for proposals right now. Those will very likely have many of the features that the regional centers would have. And what they're missing, though, is perhaps a focus on solving some kind of regional problem. They're more nationally focused right now. So that's the one thing that's missing, but it's a huge step in that direction.
But there's a big difference between the hubs as proposed by the administration versus the Brookings proposal in that no money would go towards infrastructure with the hubs. It would use existing infrastructure, so it's easier to compete
That's a detail within a broader concept. So I think
it's an important detail.
Yeah, but it's one that can be eliminated. So the hubs, which we're competing for, by the way,
Yeah.
A multi multiple hubs, and which will win at least one. And so we know, because our ideas will prevail. As we did win one of the Frontier Energy Research Centers, we just won one of those, on photosynthetic replicants, by the way, plant-machine hybrids. And so you're right to avoid politicization down to that local level, and the way that you do that is through strict, rigorous competition, no exceptions.
Okay. Thank you. And I guess you would argue that one of the criteria for choice of the place would be local capability.
Yeah, absolutely.
Quick question from you.
Yes. My name is Sam Lake, and I'm from the Council on Competitiveness. A couple of years ago, we wrote a piece called Cooperate about universities and regional economic development, and we wrote about SkySong.
Yes.
A couple of years after that, I had the privilege of visiting SkySong. Right. For those of you who don't know, I can't even describe it in a few words, but it's this holistic place where all kinds of activities, entrepreneurial, et cetera, are encouraged and go on that is run by Arizona State University. Here's my question. What I like about SkySong, right, is it's attuned to the kind of serendipity of free enterprise capitalism. If an opportunity arises and somebody goes to SkySong, they can get a foreign partner, they can get assistance from university professors, a whole menu full of opportunities to take advantage of it. So what troubles me is when we start defining things as clusters, are we running the risk of defining out this element of capitalism, which is serendipity? Like, if Bill Gates hadn't moved to Seattle, we wouldn't have Microsoft there.
So SkySong, we run exactly as you observed, which is it is a transaction time reduction facility. And so it's how do you take your idea and move it as rapidly as possible through whatever transactions you have to do to take your idea and move it forward. And so, and we had partners. City of Scottsdale is a partner. University is a partner. Private developers are partners, and then we have over 50 companies that we have brought there from 20 different countries. And so, I think the way that we avoid what you're talking about is by focusing on the problem. That's what I talk about: the outcome, the problem, and then not establishing a rigid structure in a region that this is somehow your innovation cluster, because that will never work. And then you allow them to assemble, back to the earlier question, you allow them to assemble to focus on the problem, and then all the natural juices inside the university, inside the startup company, inside the established company, they just flow on their own. So you facilitate it around the focus, but not around the building of structure. In fact, if we were to go back and edit the Brookings report, we'd take out some of that structure stuff and stay focused on the ideas. And so I think both those comments are absolutely right.
So how would you have
Thank
the
you.
Federal government
we had
fund that?
One question. Okay. Thank you. We're already behind in our time. Thank you, Michael, very much for a very stimulating. Okay, our first panel is Why Clusters Matter, Innovation Clusters and Economic Growth. Our moderator is William Kittredge. Our are Marianne Feldman and Andrew Kramer.